Hi, you're listening to Petri.com's MJF Chat Show. I am Mary Jo Foley, aka your Petri.com community magnet, and I am here to interview tech industry experts about various topics that you, our readers and listeners, want to know about. Today's MJF Chat is going to be all about Azure Compute, and my special guest today is Aaron Chappell, who is the Microsoft Corporate Vice President in charge of Azure Compute. Thank you, Aaron, so much for doing this chat with me.
It's amazing to be here today, Mary Jo.
So, all you listeners, I first met Aaron virtually in 2010 because I was writing a series called Microsoft's Women Worth Watching. And I found out that in 1998, Aaron was hired by Microsoft to work on Small Business Server, and she spent 4 years there working on the first four releases of that product. And guess what? She's still here.
When something's good, Mary Jo, you don't leave it.
I know. So then just over a year ago, you became Corporate Vice President of Azure Compute after being a key executive in Windows Server for years. So I think it would be interesting for our listeners and readers to hear what you do in your new job. Like, what do you do as the head of Azure Compute?
Well, Mary Jo, in simplest form, my job is all about creating Azure fans, right? Cloud customers are evolving, and so are the requirements. They not only expect the cloud to work, they're looking for the best cloud platform, they're looking for services to run everything from their legacy workloads to mission critical workloads to cloud native workloads and everything in between, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. And so it's really my responsibility to ensure from the smallest customer, like those SBS customers initially, all the way to the largest customers and our enterprise customers, that we deliver both the fundamentals, but also the latest innovation that's really necessary for them to run their business. Mm-hmm. Okay. So whether it be existing enterprise customer who's looking to migrate Windows and SQL workloads to the cloud, and they're looking for comprehensive migration tooling, or whether or not it's an organization that really requires a broad set of flexibility and range of IaaS offerings, and the enterprise-grade security and management to operate their environment, or if it's a cloud native startup that's looking for agile PaaS offerings that integrate with the best developer tooling, you know, all of these are things that I think of on a day-to-day basis. And it really is about enabling the end-to-end experiences for customers across both those IaaS and PaaS layers, as well as the common management experience and tooling that I live and breathe.
Okay. Do you also have oversight for Azure storage and Azure networking as part of your domain as well?
I work very closely with the Azure storage and networking teams, right? We really think of compute, network, and storaging as the core of Azure. And so that isn't, you know, directly in my kind of line of responsibility, but my partner, Tad Brockway, who leads the product for both networking and storage, and I are joined at the hip, and we really share, right, that mission around delivering Azure fans.
Okay. So I think it would be interesting for our listeners to hear how someone like you, who knew all about Windows Server, like everything from the base components like the kernel, the hypervisor, containers, and storage, prepared you to move to Azure. And the reason I'm asking about this is I know we have a lot of IT pros who always wonder how much skills transfer is there really between on-prem and the cloud?
Well, I like to think that my journey really mirrors that of our customers, right? I've migrated from on-premises to the cloud. Right. And so I really see, you know, in some sense, the having the perspective from both of those, you know, points of view, how it really helps me be a better leader and deliver better products. Mm-hmm. And so I have knowledge of the environments and the reality that our customers face, right? That few businesses are going to be 100% in the public cloud. Right. And again, I think that makes me better at my job because I deeply understand the requirements and challenges that our customers face. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits of you know, Azure and the work that we were doing on Windows Server and the operating system all coming together is that, even though my predominant focus is on compute and the public cloud, I work with many enterprise customers that are hybrid today, and they want that flexibility and choice as they use our platform to solve their problems. And I get to continue to work deeply with the Windows Server organization. And that's a treat for me, given my history and all of the people that I know there and the amazingly talented engineers that we have. But it also really helps us work together in thinking about how we help enterprises and small businesses and the like really modernize their on-premises environment and embrace the cloud.
Okay, that's great.
I will say one more thing, which is that in terms of skills transfer, I don't think that the change that we're going through from on-premises to the cloud is very much unlike the transition that we saw over a decade ago when we thought about moving from physical servers to virtualization. Right? If you remember back there during the transition, IT pros found themselves faced with a new set of challenges, right? A new set of challenges in their environment. How do they manage the explosion, right, of virtual machines that came from this newfound ease that you could just create one easily? And that's not unlike what you can do in the public cloud. And so, when they were used to controlling the environment through the depth of knowledge they had in the physical world, new challenges emerged around things like governing the environment, around securing it, around automating it. And so if you fast forward today, the challenges in the hybrid world are similar. You have VMs running on premises and in the public cloud. How do you govern across them? How do you set policy? How do you get your arms around what can seem like chaos, right? When any developer can spin up a container. But how do you really think about and get your arms around and attest to the health of your estate? Which, I think at the end of the day, IT pros really see themselves as stewards of the safety and the governance and the compliance of the environment that they're running for the business. And so in the public cloud, there's still containers in the cloud. You still need storage. You have to understand your network. You need a set of corporate standards. And so while the tools may be different, the same foundation and the same conceptual thinking, still, persists, whether or not you be on premises in the public cloud or in your hybrid world.
Okay, that's good. So the next question I have for you is very high level, and I'll tell you why it's so high level. So when I am looking for things to write about or topics regarding the cloud, I go to azure.microsoft.com, and there's literally hundreds of services up there, right? So sometimes prioritizing and figuring out what's really exciting, what's really new, what's really happening is tough because there's so many things going on simultaneously. So I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, what do you think is the most exciting thing happening in Azure Compute right now and why?
Mary Jo, I knew you were going to ask me one question that was going to, have the potential to stump me in some sense. And I like, this is the one. It seems like maybe the most basic question, but it's the hardest thing you'll ask me. And it is because of what you said. There's so many things that are going on. But I think the thing that most excites me about the work that we're doing is, where we're solving real customer problems, either given the current environment that they face, or where we see the future of cloud computing going. So if you'll humor me, I kind of have more than one thing that I'd love to kind of tap in on.
Yeah, sure.
The first I would say is, if I just look at the current environment, what we've seen as a result of the global crisis going on around COVID and 19 and the pandemic, is just customers really need to move securely to remote work, to take advantage or think about how are they future-proofing some of the investments that they have on premises. And so, the work that we've done in WVD and the Windows Virtualized Desktop, we saw tremendous growth in that initially, and we just see it as being the only solution out there that really offers, you know, Windows 10 multi-session virtual desktops, which are super important in today's environment. And, you know, customers were able to quickly get off the ground with what we're doing in WVD. And then that innovation in there continues with integration that we've done with Teams, right, to be able to offload and encode work from the call to the endpoint so you get better latency and more natural calling experience. It's all about that user experience at the end and helping to make users productive. So WVD definitely is an area that really excites me. Along with that, the work we've done in migration, and I know you covered this recently, but just the tooling work that we've done and really shifting to take more of a workload focus so that we can get those customers who, you know, they may be looking to move out of an on-premises data center because the lease is expiring and, you know, they want to have both the cost benefit of the cloud, but also maybe not have to rely on having, you know, workforce going in physically to their own data center in order to manage it. Or they're looking at, you know, migrating, you know, just those legacy workloads in order to be able to take advantage of some of the no cloud operations. So all the work we're doing in migration, really, you know, from inventory to helping create a clear strategy to workload-based productions, all of those pieces are I think, really exciting and help address a customer's, you know, current problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I do want to talk a little bit maybe about the future because, you know, that's sort of the reality of today. But, you know, the work that we have going on in the confidential computing space to me is something that's very forward looking in terms of helping customers to be able to, you know, encrypt data in use, right? You know, today we encrypt it in transit and encrypt it at rest, but what happens if someone manages to get admin access to a VM, right? If in the confidential computing space, they now, you know, they can't get encrypted access to the enclave and the data and the code that's there is secure. And so there are just a set of scenarios, I think, in finance, in healthcare and government that this unlocks that, you know, we're going to see more and more of in the coming months, years. And so the investment we're making there now in order to prepare us for the future is another area that really excites me.
Cool. Okay. I've written a little about confidential computing, but I always feel like I'm in way over my head on that one whenever I write about it.
Me too sometimes, Mary Jo.
Yep. So speaking of being in over your head, when I first started covering Azure, I remember it was at that point a platform as a service play, and then Microsoft later expanded it to an infrastructure as a service play. And a lot of people thought that was because, you know, that was the easy way to get into the cloud. Like an easy way to stick your toe in the water was to start with IaaS and then commit all the way to new applications being built from the ground up for PaaS. Is this still a pattern that you are seeing? Like, are people still going IaaS and PaaS, or are some people really just going all in on PaaS directly?
You know, Mary Jo, it's all over the place in many sense. And it can be that even within a single organization, right? If an organization is large enough, they might have a department that really is looking, right? They're more nascent in their cloud engagement, and they're going to start from an IaaS point of view and look at how can they get the benefit of the cloud and start to move from a cloud operations point of view by taking some of their more legacy workloads and doing that more lift and shift in some sense into IaaS. Mm-hmm. But there also might be other parts of the organization who are building out net new applications. And, you know, at the end of the day, I love to talk about infrastructure, but infrastructure is in and of itself isn't really valuable at all, right? It's about powering the business application. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, let's think about even in today's world, let's take a retail, right? Retail's gone through some pretty dramatic changes over the last 6 months. And so as you think about a retailer that's had to respond to new ways of customer purchasing, things like curbside pickup scenarios, other online changes, you know, they're going to potentially be building a net new application, and they might start more from a PaaS point of view, either, you know, kind of containers at one end of it or all the way to serverless, in the sense that they want to be able to focus their expertise on the business logic and the business application and not have to worry about that underlying infrastructure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have, you know, people who start with PAS, people who start with IaaS, and almost everything in between, even within the same company. And that's, I think, what we're about. We're about providing customers with that flexibility of choice and being able to do it in a consistent environment with consistent tooling and a consistent experience with the Azure portal and the command line tooling, and then integration with our developer tools, right, in VS Code and Git, in order to provide that end-to-end solution where you can, it's almost choose your own adventure. You could start wherever you want to. And it is driven by your business need.
Okay. On the topic of IaaS, it was just about a year ago, I think, that Microsoft said Linux was about 50% of the IaaS workloads in Azure, which when I remember when we wrote about that, people were like, no, that can't be true. That there's no way that can be true. And I'm like, nope, it's true. So I'm curious, is that trend still continuing? And I don't know if you can give us an updated number on that or not, but like is Linux still the main kind of growth spurt in IaaS right now?
Yeah, I don't have the exact number offhand, but I can definitely confirm that our Linux workloads continue to be a growing trend in Azure, and we continue to be over 50%. And there's a number of things I think that are driving that. One, our engagement and our relationship with our large enterprise customers, large enterprises are not a homogeneous environment, right? They have both Linux and Windows. And so as they bring their workloads to the cloud, we're going to see growth, and we're going to see growth across both the Windows base as well as the Linux space. The other interesting thing is the AKS service, the Azure Kubernetes Service. And so, it's our fastest growing compute service ever. And until recently, we only supported Linux containers, right? The general availability of Windows container support was earlier this year. And so AKS is almost entirely Linux at this point in time. Again, I think that will change over time. But I think that one of the things that we've really done from a Microsoft point of view is to engage and be very thoughtful about how we think of our relationship with, our contribution with, our support of the open source world. And so, we have many Microsoft employees that hold elected positions in the open source community. Many of our employees have been awarded community participation. And I think that's a real shift in terms of just the value we place on that and how we see that not only helping the community, but also helping ultimately our customers, because they are engaging with and using various components of the open source community that are critical to their running their business.
Okay. On the topic of AKS, Azure Kubernetes Service, I still find myself a little confused about AKS versus Service Fabric, because when I read descriptions of these or hear people talking about them, I'm like, wait, aren't these kind of doing the same thing? So I'm curious, are they doing the same thing? And does Microsoft still actually recommend customers, other than Microsoft itself, which has a bunch of products built on Service Fabric, to continue to use Service Fabric at this point? Or do you just say, if you're trying to achieve those kind of goals, use AKS?
Well, our investments in Service Fabric predate Kubernetes by many years. And you're familiar with Mary Jo, it still powers lots of Azure's internal infrastructure. So we continue to support Service Fabric as a place we continue to invest in. It's very much a thing. I think that the thing that sometimes gets missed is that Service Fabric supports stateful workloads natively, right? Which means you can store data inside the Service Fabric cluster versus attaching to an external storage the way Kubernetes does. And that's an important capability for Azure. And it's also important for some customer workloads like gaming, where stateful capability helps really decrease the latency and makes the application more performant. So it really is going to depend upon the application. Now, for most customers, I would say Kubernetes provides the right feature set and has a lot of momentum in the industry. And again, that's why AKS remains the fastest growing service that we've launched in the history of Azure Compute. The one other thing that I'll call out, though, is that we are looking at our investments in Service Fabric and looking at how we can use that to power the next generation of the serverless container platform inside Azure. And so, we can apply some of those perf and scale benefits from Service Fabric even in the container-based world, so that our customers can benefit from that investment and the capabilities that we provide via Service Fabric.
I'm glad you brought up serverless because I feel like A few years ago, I was writing a lot about serverless. Like I kept getting briefed on Azure Functions, and it seemed like, AWS was doing a lot with serverless, and Microsoft was, and everybody was. And now I just don't hear about it as much. So I was curious what's happening in serverless, and is it still a hot button?
So the short answer is yes, it's still a hot button and there's lots happening. The
Okay.
longer answer I'd say is that, we've learned more about the developer community and what developers are looking for is the right tool to build modern applications. So similar to how I've talked about providing flexibility on the infrastructure, we really want to provide that flexibility and choice to the developer. So all the way from your low code options, right, that really are focused on maximizing productivity, to more serverless options, which balance both that productivity but as well as control, and then all the way to kind of the spectrum of Kubernetes and what you can do in the container space. And if you look at that frame, even within the serverless space, it's a very broad term that crosses a lot of territory. When we talk to customers, they often have specific needs that they're trying to address. And so I think one of the reasons you've heard us move away maybe from the serverless as an umbrella term is we really want to focus in on, Azure Functions. Azure Functions is extremely popular with customers who have high, value high productivity. They just want to write the business logic and not have to worry about the infrastructure. But it's not just Azure Functions. It's things like Azure Web Apps, Azure Logic Apps, Azure Container Instances, right? That serverless container investment that we've made and we continue to make. And so it's all about how do we provide customers with attractive economics, as well as the flexibility of invisible infrastructure in order to accelerate their software teams. One of the places that I see that's pretty hot right now is actually in the API management space. So we have a large kind of restaurant franchise that's working with API management, and they've been able to publish the APIs from their services that are running on App Service to both first-party web and mobile apps. And so think about it in the recent months as the delivery, service, food service has taken off even more so than it was. By exposing those APIs to food delivery partners in their environment, who can then build applications on top of it, right? They've been able to create, a new stream of both customers for them and then ultimately business. And so, again, I think there's a number of different options here, and it really is about providing customers with that choice to be able to tailor the platform to what it is that they're trying to do for their business and their business applications.
Can I ask you about Azure Arc as my
Yes.
question? Okay. So last year at Ignite, I think, which was the last time I saw you in person, we talked and heard a lot about Azure Arc, which I felt like is taking Microsoft's management experience to the next level and making it multi-cloud. I thought when I heard about this at Ignite last year, I have to say I was a little confused and I was trying to kind of parse what it meant and what pieces were there and what pieces weren't there yet. But I'm curious now, a year later, do you think customers understand what Microsoft's trying to do with Arc and are they buying into it?
I've been delighted by the response to Azure Arc and how our
Okay.
customers are seeing the value. And I think it goes back to what I talked about earlier in our chat around, hybrid is here, right? It's not going away. In fact,
Right.
most customers will run in a hybrid environment. And as those customers think about ways to move from on-premises to the cloud, the thing that's most challenging is not necessarily the technology, it's the management and operations. And so, for me, Arc at its core is really around providing customers with two things: consistency and flexibility. The first challenge that Arc addresses is providing that consistent way to govern and operate across Azure on-premises and multi-cloud. And we do this by taking Azure's control plane and extending it on-premises into the multi-cloud environment. And what this enables customers to do is to use Azure's management capabilities on resources that live outside of Azure. So for example, customers can use Azure to set policy, to secure, to manage virtual machines, physical servers, Kubernetes clusters they're running right in their on-premise environment, maybe on top of their Azure Stack HCI cluster, maybe on top of a Windows Server machines, on top of, other providers' infrastructure. And so that really helps the customers have this consistent experience, the single pane of glass, in order to be able to reduce that chaos and the complexity that see. So let me give you one example. Fujitsu is a service provider that we work with, and in working with Azure Arc in preview, they've been able to quickly deploy a common set of Azure policies on servers that they're managing both across on-premises and multi-cloud to be able to optimize their business operations. And that has real tangible value in terms of the time and money that they've been able to save. Now, that second challenge is really around flexibility. Right. And the reality of most customers being hybrid, providing flexibility on where to run the applications, because again, as I said, infrastructure is really all about enabling the applications. That flexibility of running those applications anywhere they want to is equally important. And so that the second challenge that Arc really addresses is providing consistent services across Azure, on-premises, and multi-cloud to enable the portability and flexibility of application deployment and development. So with Azure Arc, it enables customers to deploy, for example, Azure Data Services on any K8s environment. It could be Red Hat OpenShift, PKS, VMware. And then with Azure Arc-enabled data services, customers can benefit from the Evergreen data service and pay only what they use. They can leverage the existing infrastructure they have in place. And they have that ability to, in some sense, late bind to where they want to deploy the application. And so, I get example of this. KPMG Ignition Tokyo is rolling out a next generation AI-based audit software that's built on Azure, and they've implemented Azure Arc to deliver that seamless solution for clients across multiple hybrid data estates using Azure Arc-enabled data services. So consistency of the management and operations, and then flexibility of the application and services across, right, that reality of what we see as a hybrid world.
Okay, that's great. I want to talk to you about Gartner. Gartner, they periodically publish magic quadrants for cloud infrastructure and platform services. And their latest one is still very bullish about Azure, not surprisingly, but they did ding Microsoft on a couple of counts. And I'd be curious to hear your take on their criticisms. Excuse me. One of them, they said, was that Azure has the lowest ratio of availability zones to regions of any vendor. And the other was about guaranteed capacity. And they were talking even before the pandemic that Microsoft was having trouble meeting the demands of customers who wanted guaranteed capacity. So I'm curious if you could talk, even in the most broad strokes, about what is Microsoft doing in these two areas, if they are areas of concern for the company.
Resiliency is incredibly important to our customers and to Microsoft. So let me talk about both the availability zones and capacity. Microsoft has the most regions globally by far. And while our disaster resilience strategy historically has relied solely on region pairs, right, which we still continue to believe is the best approach to protecting against true disasters, availability zones are a huge part of our strategy to enable customers to choose the best continuity solution that's right for their organization. Availability zones are fault-isolated locations within an Azure region, and they provide redundant power, cooling network, and allow customers to run mission-critical applications with higher availability and fault tolerance to data center failures. Today, we have 14 availability zones that are offered across 10 total regions, including the United States, Western Europe, Japan, and Southeast Asia. And our roadmap includes delivering availability zones in the 60-plus cloud regions announced, with specific new region availability zones to be announced later this month and throughout the rest of the calendar year. So it is important to us, and it continues to be an area where we work towards providing coverage across the 60-plus cloud regions that we have currently announced today. From a capacity standpoint, we designed Azure to operate at global scale, right? And Microsoft has a global all-hazards approach to our business continuity and crisis management planning. Now, during the initial month of the pandemic, we did need to address capacity demands for a small number of customers. And the company, I was part of, it acted quickly, prioritized the capacity first for our life and health first responders, and then we came together to support all of our customers. And capacity was restored for all the regions and restrictions removed in April. And we were encouraged by the positive trajectory that we continue to see from the steps that we learned and took during that period of time. For example, we did see significant increases in our cloud services. We saw more than 200 million meeting participants in a single day in the month of March that generated 4.1 billion meeting minutes. And so being able to respond to this and take care of our customers and continue to invest, and learn from what we've done, we again are very encouraged by the trajectory we're seeing and the steps that we took.
I have one more question for you before we're done. And I wanted to throw in a WVD question, Windows Virtual Desktop. I know this because of the pandemic and even before the pandemic, this service, which is hosted on Azure, is one of the fastest growing services of all times for Microsoft. And so I'm like kind of trying to figure out how to think about WVD, right? So I've got some of my readers who say, WVD, that's the future of Windows. Like from, in the near term, everything is just going to be a virtual desktop and there's not going to be any more local desktops. Then you've got other people saying, no, I want there to continue to be locally installed Windows clients and I want to keep working that way. So my question for you is, when I'm thinking about WVD, do I think of it almost like I think about hybrid and cloud, or is the end game someday WVD is the future of Windows?
This is Aaron's personal opinion.
Okay.
I think it is exactly like hybrid.
I kind of do too. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
it's about choice and flexibility for the customer. And there are going to be scenarios like, are you going to be cloud connected with the right internet bandwidth in some, super remote location or when you're, out on a oil rig? I don't know.
Yeah,
right?
Right.
And so I think for governance, compliance, all of the reasons we see customers continuing to invest in on-premises infrastructure, as well as wanting to have redundancy, right, of their solutions, I think you're going to continue to see both, right, the on-premises, so to say, which is the Windows client and the Windows desktop in its form that we know and love, as well as WVD, be places that we continue to invest in, that we see customers delight in how they use that in order to be productive and get their work done.
Okay. Good. I'm glad I'm on the same page with you on that, because so many people are like, nope, this is it. Like WVD, they're not going to do anything more on Windows. And I'm like, I don't know. That doesn't seem right to me, but yeah. Anyway, Aaron, thank you so much for doing this chat. I know how busy you are, especially with all the work from home and craziness. So thanks again for making the time.
I have to say, Mary Jo, it's been a delight. And honestly, we're heading into Ignite, which is my favorite time of year for many reasons.
Yes.
But one of it is that we normally, get to connect in person and catch up. And so it was lovely to chat with you today. And I hope you have great plans for Ignite. I hope your listeners have registered and are going to join us. We've got some amazing demos, customer testimonials, and just announcements that you won't want to miss. So thanks for having me today.
Yeah, I'm excited. I also love Ignite and I'm looking forward to it. Next week, going to be covering it all around the clock. Well, not really, but sort of. And for everyone else who's listening to our chat right now or reading this chat, I will be posting more information soon on Petri about who my next guest is going to be. Once you see that, you can submit questions directly on Twitter for that guest. And in the meantime, if you know of anyone else or even yourself who might make a good guest for one of these MJF chats, please do not hesitate to drop me a note. Thank you very much.